very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
The questions you always had, the answers you were never given, the place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
To everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas at veritasradio.com. I'm your host, Mel Vambergas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home. Now, you hear it every week. If you want to listen to tonight's full interview and every single interview we have ever done, click on the subscribe button of our website and enjoy the truth. If you want to get in touch with me, want to be a guest on this radio program, have a guest suggestion, or simply have feedback, I always love to hear from you. Click on the contact button of our website. And tonight, we reveal the uncensored record of the planned extermination of Indigenous children in Canada's murderous Indian residential schools, based on eyewitness testimonies and archival documentation deliberately suppressed or ignored. Tonight's guest will present proof that the genocide of Indigenous people began as a religion-led campaign and continues to be a deliberate government policy in Canada. These are some of the startling facts. Over half of Indian residential school children began dying the very first year these church-run facilities were opened. This huge mortality rate continued unabated for over half a century because of deliberate practices of germ warfare, according to prescribed monthly death quota. Evidence of these crimes and their intentional nature has been continually destroyed by the RCMP and the Catholic, Anglican, and United Church since at least 1960. The same genocide continues today and is aimed at Indigenous women and children and is driven by foreign corporate interests, hungry for native lands and resources. This is an urgent summons to the world and to all Canadians to live no longer under genocidal regimes. And to tell us more, tonight's special guest is Kevin Annett, a Canadian Nobel Peace Prize nominee in 2013, 14, and 15, a community minister, human rights consultant, and special advisor to the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and author. And we have a more comprehensive bio on our website. And directly from somewhere in Canada, I would like to welcome Kevin Annett to Veritas. Hello, Kevin, and welcome.
Thank you, Mel. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And this is one of those cases that I've been following for a few years now, but for some reason, we haven't been able to converge. But recently, you and I met in person in Philadelphia, and we arranged this interview. And folks, this is one of those interviews that I know it's probably going to be hard to digest, but nobody said that truth should always make you happy. Truth should always make you free. So I always like to discuss events in chronological order. First, how, when, and why did you become involved in this investigation? And if you can tell briefly what the investigation is all about before we can dissect it.
Sure, Mel. For me, it began in a very basic way. I was a United Church clergyman on the west coast of Canada in the year 1992. I was in my mid-30s then, happily married with two young children, two daughters. And I was positioned at a church in Port Alberni, which is in the center of Vancouver Island. Unbeknownst to me, it was the center of the big missionary invasion on the west coast in the late 19th century that killed off about 90% of all the Indians there. And the same kind of pattern you had all over the west coast of America, California and Oregon and so on. In Canada, it was led by the churches, as you mentioned. And I began to uncover the result of that genocide in the Native people I began to meet. I was invited to build up a church, St. Andrew's United Church. It was down to only about 10 people. They wanted me to bring in new blood, so I did. I went out into the community and began to bring in a lot of Native people who were very poor. They're about a third of the population in that part of Vancouver Island, and so they began to come to the food bank that I opened in the church. And there in the food bank and in my church, we began to hear the stories. And we had an open pulpit policy. Anybody could get up and speak. And that's when we began to hear these stories of the children being killed and tortured in the local Alberni residential school run by my employer at the time, the United Church. When I first began to encounter Native people who began to come to the church, the stories they began to tell were quite unbelievable. Now, unbelievable from the point of view of a white Canadian, but of course, Native people knew this reality. And so they were finally thankful that they had the chance to talk about it. It caused an immediate conflict in my church. I was visited very soon by top officials in the United Church who warned me to my face that if I continued to allow Native people to speak from my pulpit, I may face a bad repercussion. And I felt I had an obligation to allow people to speak. That what I felt was my job as a minister of Christ, that was to seek out the lost and to help those we had wronged. So I continued to allow them to do that. Because I had grown the church so much, my congregation very much supported me. And for a while, I had that protection. But eventually, after about 2.5 years of allowing this, I built up our church to over 100 people. The church was really thriving. I found out that the United Church, along with the Catholic and the Anglican Church, had stolen a lot of Native land in the time of the early missionaries. And the church had then sold off that land to a lot of big logging companies and mining companies and made a lot of money, and none of that ever returned to the natives. Now, I knew that that was wrong. According even to our own church policy, that was wrong. They weren't allowed to do that. So I wrote a letter about that, and within 2 weeks, I was summarily fired without cause, without notice of any kind. It turns out that I had disrupted a major corporate acquisition by the Weyerhaeuser Company of Seattle, a big logging, huge multinational. And there was a little backroom deal going on between the United Church and the provincial government and that. And my exposure of that deal, you know, threatened to upset it. So I was fired quickly. I was threatened with defrocking immediately. There was no due process. And they even went to my wife and offered to pay for her divorce if she'd leave me, which she did.
Really?
That's right. That was one of the more shocking things. But it was one of the things that made me and others realize that there was some much bigger agenda going on here. I mean, you don't do that to a lone minister unless there's something, some big hornet's nest that he's shaken. So it was all the beginning of a long education for me.
That's incredible. And this is what year?
This happened in January 1995 is when I was fired. And very soon after, yeah.
1995. And you started really looking into this what year?
That same year, because after I was fired, I wasn't allowed to work at all. I was blacklisted. I was invited down into the downtown part of Vancouver, where I'd had a long history working as a street minister. And at the very same time that I was fired, the first lawsuits were beginning against Canada, brought by survivors of these death camps that they called residential schools. And I was asked to be an advisor to the lawyers because of all the research I'd done and the work I'd done with Native people. And we began to build a movement to expose these crimes, not just in the courts of Canada, but in the streets. I began to document the stories over years. And these stories involved not just the physical and sexual assaults that were reported in the mainstream press. We're talking sterilization programs, medical experimentation, slave labor regimes, the deliberate exposure of children to tuberculosis and then letting them die en masse to depopulate whole areas. This is out-and-out genocide by every definition, and we kept pushing that point. We began to protest outside and inside churches. We began to get a lot of headlines, and eventually we forced the Canadian government to even issue an apology over it in the year 2008. But that took many years of struggle.
So 1995, and that's the same year you started looking into this, and the same year you were basically fired. There was not that much time before you became a persona non grata within the church. Now, this has been happening for over 100 years, correct?
Well, in terms of the residential schools, they began in the year 1889 and they closed in 1996. So we're talking 107 years history of this, relatively recent history.
Can we go back in time to the beginning? Because a lot of people may think that this is new, but this has been happening not only in Canada, but in the United States. It's almost like the script is repeated throughout not only the United States, I can tell you Mexico as well, where they're actually building churches on top of some of the temples that the indigenous people had before. So the script continues throughout this hemisphere. Can you take us from there?
Sure. Well, you know, it's one of the oldest stories in the world, really. Genocide goes back many centuries. The largest genocide numerically in human history happened on this continent. We figure over 20 million people were slaughtered. It's hard to estimate numbers, but to give you an example, from the west coast of Canada, the before Europeans arrived, anthropologists, and I know one of my undergraduate degrees was in anthropology in Vancouver, and I studied this thoroughly. The estimated population of pre-European West Coast Canada was over 2 million Indians. By the year 1920, it was down to less than 20,000. That's a 99% depopulation rate that's never happened anywhere else in the world. And so, you know, this is a very long intentional genocide aimed at indigenous people. And if you take it back far enough, it comes out of Rome. It comes out of papal bulls of the Catholic Church that said that anyone who wasn't a Catholic didn't have the right to live. They didn't have a soul. And once they were baptized, they could be legally enslaved. But prior to that, they could be slaughtered en masse. And that gave the legal sanction and the moral sanction for everything that happened on this continent. But you're right. The same kind of, you know, internment camps where they had these children and killed off so many of them. That happened all over America, and in fact, I've worked with survivors from Washington State and South Dakota and others who describe exactly the same kinds of murderous crimes going on there.
This is just incredible. I'm just looking at history and what we do. What is it? 99% of the people. Now, are these events considered the Canadian Holocaust, Kevin?
Well, yes, that's the. It clearly was massive genocide, intentional as well. You know, it's kind of like the mindset, Mel, is, well, it's too bad that so many of them died. They got smallpox and died. We didn't intend it. It's just a sad thing. Well, 300 years ago, people knew that smallpox was a communicable disease and that it spread and killed people like wildfire. We also have, and if you go to one of my websites, murderbydecree.com, that's one of my latest books, at the back of murderbydecree.com, you'll see a story about an Anglican missionary called John Sheepshanks, who in the year 1864 went among the Chilcotin Indians of central British Columbia and inoculated all of them with smallpox. Within 3 weeks, 90% of the Chilcotins were dead, and the land was then bought up by his fellow shareholders in the Puget Sound Land Company, which was owned by the Hudson's Bay Company, the biggest landowner in Canada. So the church went in, wiped out the natives, and then profited by it directly. And that's the kind of pattern you see, the kind of tag team going on between church, state, and private companies.
Didn't the Spaniards do the same thing when they came to this part of the world as well? If you look at the history of smallpox, they brought these blankets full of smallpox. And of course, we know what happened there.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Spanish strategy was slightly different than the French and the English. In North America, the Spanish were out to get gold and land, and they just slaughtered everybody in their path. The English and the French, like in Canada, needed some of the Indians as allies, like the Huron and the Mohawk and others were military allies for a while of these European powers. So the strategies were different, but the aim was the same, to eventually wipe them all out. And, you know, a classic example, remember last September, Pope Francis, who's posing as a big reformer, came to America. Well, right in the midst of all of his very humane talk, he canonized a man called Junipero Serra, who was a Franciscan missionary in California, near what's now San Francisco. And he was responsible for the death of over 20,000 Indians. He worked them to death on plantations because they weren't Catholics. There were hundreds of them buried in a mass grave and right in downtown Oakland under one of the Catholic churches. And in the eyes of Pope Francis and the Catholic Church, he's a saint. Now, you know, it shows you that the mentality doesn't really change over time.
And I see a report here by some estimates, smallpox may have killed 75% of the Inca Empire. Now, with what you said, first of all, we know the perception is these soulless savages, and therefore anything can happen to them. But you're saying that once they're baptized, they're not cleansed, they're basically slaves?
Yeah, the best you could hope for if you weren't a Catholic at the time was you could be baptized, and then the best you could hope for would be to be a slave. You could be worked to death, but not openly killed. You know, there was this farce that whenever the Spanish came into an area, they would read in Latin a declaration that the Indians had the chance to convert on the spot, and so they wouldn't be killed. If the Indians didn't respond, and of course, how could they, because they didn't understand right. Latin, they could then be legally slaughtered by the conquistadors, which is what happened. So the church, in other words, was sanctioning the whole thing, just like they did in Canada with the residential schools.
Now, how do you feel? How do you reconcile being a religious man that you were or are after you discovered that the church was behind all of these deplorable crimes?
Well, you know, Mel, even if I hadn't been forced out of the church, I would have left, because morally I couldn't be part of a tradition or an institution that with that kind of blood on its hands and that openly violated all the teachings and spirit of Jesus himself. So while I still consider myself spiritually, you know, in the spirit of Jesus and his, you know, if you like, that evangelical tradition, I don't at all connect that with organized religion and the Christian churches, which are really arms of the state. They've acted for centuries like an empire, mm-hmm. and they have really nothing to do with the man from Nazareth.
This is just incredible. And I'm looking at something interesting here, folks. Section 2 of the United Nations Genocide Convention states that genocide is intent to commit the crime, not the crime itself. This loophole has allowed regimes guilty of genocide to evade prosecution, Canada included, since it is nearly impossible to uncover a specific intent behind an array of historical actions by a state power. Your reaction about this?
Well, that's exactly what happened. The guy who drafted the Genocide Convention of the United Nations, his name was Raphael Lemkin, and you know, he had a personal interest in genocide, his entire family being wiped out in Poland by the Nazis. And he worked for the U.S. State Department. He drafted the original United Nations Convention on Genocide. And in it, it simply stated, genocide is when you kill off a whole people. It didn't say anything about intent, because the intent was implied by the action itself.
Right.
And that was confirmed in Nuremberg. Robert Jackson, the chief U.S. prosecutor, said, we do not need proof of intent when a whole regime is out to wipe out other people. The intent is proven by their acts. And that was Lemkin's simple definition of it. Now, Canada and the United States and Great Britain got on the committee to draft the final version of his convention, and they rewrote it totally. They did two things. They made it so that the wording made it the loophole you mentioned. They said, well, you not only need the act, but you need to show that they intended to do the act, which is a lawyer's trick. It means, well, how do you prove that, like, where is it written down that we intend to wipe out a people? It isn't. So that was a loophole that would get regimes out of being prosecuted. They also made it up to each nation whether they wanted to bring enabling legislation and to allow that convention to be applied within their own country, and nobody did. So it was a nice statement, but it could never be used to actually prosecute regimes for genocide.
But if the action of killing requires energy, that is, you assume there's intent.
Absolutely. You know, that's why, for example, to give you some examples from the research I've done in Canada, there was a standard practice of simply, and this was confirmed by many employees on the ground in letters I published, the standard practice was any child who arrived at a residential school was automatically raped and beaten and locked in a room. Standard practice. Now, if you're part of that system, if you're the bus driver or the teacher, and even if you don't take part in the rapes, you're part of a regime that's planning to slaughter children. And the intent is implicit in the very system itself. So the entire system is guilty, and anybody within it is automatically. That's the law. That's criminal law.
Do you think that these organized religions have hijacked their true teachings of Jesus and the rest of them?
Well, very much. And you can see how it happened historically. You know, a lot's been written about that, but, you know, I witnessed it on the ground as a minister, because it's funny, every time I tried to bring this stuff up to my fellow ministers and invoked, Jesus' own words, you know, I was ridiculed by my fellow clergymen as if it was a big joke. And I saw in practice that the last place you want to try to practice Christianity is within the churches, because they talk it, but they won't walk it. If they tried walking it, they'd be in trouble. For example, the most basic teaching of Jesus is to love your enemy and not engage in warfare. Well, imagine if the churches of America, right after the Gulf War began, had published a picture of Saddam Hussein with the words, love your enemy. I mean, they would have been locked up as terrorists. The churches know that they have to play the game for tax reasons, you know, for concessions from the government. They play the game. They support their governments in time of war. They violate the spirit of Jesus to simply love each other and to love a new creation into being, really. But they choose a simple route, which is to pick up the sword. And that's what they've done.
I live in Arizona, and we have a lot of Native American tribes here. And when I drive through roads and I go through reservations, the one thing that you see everywhere are Christian, you know, crosses everywhere, little churches, crosses. And it makes me wonder, these people did not have that religious belief before. So I wonder how they were converted.
Well, at the end of a gun and or through...
Or a sword, right.
A sword. I mean, what you do, it happened in phases, you know, Mal. The first phase was outright extermination. If you wipe out 90% of a people, the first people to die are your warriors, are your elders with the knowledge. You wipe out the tradition. And the only people left are those who can be controlled and manipulated very easily. And so you make a slave society. And it's very hard, if not impossible, to recover the original culture at that point. But another point is that a lot of the laws of the Europeans were based on the assumption that people in the indigenous people around the world didn't have an understanding of Christ. Well, what's interesting was in the very first native homes I used to visit, time and again, I'd hear from their elders, no, we had an experience of Christ. As a matter of fact, the Nootka or Nuchelnut people on the west coast of Vancouver Island, who I worked so closely with, they have a story of how before the whites came, Christ came to them in the form of a woman and warned them about these pale imposters who would come in her name, who understood the words but not the spirit behind the words, that we were to accept one another and live in equality and peace with one another and not seek to conquer each other in her name. And so what's interesting is that if the native people did have an experience of Christ beforehand, we weren't bringing them anything. And, the traditional rationale for why and how we took their land is, well, we elevated them by giving them Christianity and in turn got their land for it. But that whole thing is thrown out the window if you understand that, no, Christianity was not unique to Europe.
How many children, in your estimation, died?
In just the residential schools?
Yes.
The figure I come up with is close to 70,000 over a 100-year period. And that's probably a conservative estimate because it's based on government statistics. And the same government is now claiming only 2 to 3% of the children died when their own figures show that over 50% did. That's just in the residential schools. But don't forget, many children died after leaving. And the long-term effect of this is to continue to kill many generations after. For example, the death rate in the native world now is as high as it ever was 50 or 100 years ago, because people who have been traumatized go on and then re-traumatize the next generation. They beat, they rape, they abuse each other. And so the death rate from it is ongoing. It's intergenerational genocide.
It's more like, you know, instead of residential schools, more like boarding schools or better re-education schools. I think of a scenario where a dictator comes to power. And this happens throughout the world. As you say, the first people to go are the intellectuals, those who hold, you know, a vision for the future, and they have the history of the population, and they cannot be, quote-unquote, converted. And those who are left behind, the minority, are those who are okay to be converted, and they can start all over and be subjugated by the conquerors in a way. But when I think of this, the re-education schools, these children, they had parents, they had families, 70,000 children in 100 years. What did the parents say after the kids never came home?
Well, the parents had no right to do anything, because don't forget, under the law, still in Canada, there's a thing called the Indian Act, which is an illegal act under international law because it's aimed at a specific racial group. You're not allowed to do that. But the Indian Act says that Indians living on reservations are not citizens, they're wards of the state. which means they don't have legal rights. They can't even open a bank account. They can't vote. They can't do anything that a citizen would do. And back then, it meant that you had to sign, and one of the first documents I published, and it's in murderbydecree.com, it's called the Application for Admission Form, and every Native parent had to sign it. And in it, it says that they are signing away legal guardianship rights over their own child to the principal of the school, who's usually a clergyman. So in other words, the churches were the legal guardians. The parents had no right to do anything at that point. If they did, they'd go to jail under the law. So they were completely helpless in every way. And the churches, this is one of the things that allowed us to bring the first lawsuit against the churches, because by showing that document in court, I was able to show that, no, these are the churches were legally responsible for everything that happened to the children, including the deaths. So that really opened the floodgate for thousands of lawsuits that then hit the churches across Canada.
Why do a regular Canadian, what does he or she say about this when they are presented with the facts?
Well, they're never really presented with the facts. We've done an uphill battle to get any of this into the mainstream press. We've been blackballed right out of the media. It's funny, after the so-called apology happened in 2008, my name was never mentioned again in any of the mainstream papers. The name Kevin Annett never appeared. I was always referred to as a controversial West Coast minister. And the name Kevin Annett, it was like in South Africa when you ban somebody, their name couldn't appear in the press. The same thing in Canada. I'm just simply banned from the media. So all of the work we've done has been on the margins. It's been through internet, public events, alternative programs like yours right now. And so most Canadians don't know about these things. And when they do find out about it, their immediate response is skepticism and denial and disbelief, because it would mean that their culture has blood all over its hands, and nobody ever wants to admit that.
Now, we have a lot of listeners from Canada who support this radio program, and I know something tells me there's going to be, because I know some of them are religious people, good people, but this, the news of listening to what you're saying causes cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Because they just cannot understand or comprehend that their own churches could be behind this, not precisely their local priest or pastor or whatever, but their religious organizations are in cahoots with the government in order to make these people disappear.
Well, that's right. They not only did it in the past, they continue to do it today. Because don't forget, under the law, if somebody shoots somebody and then you hide their weapon for them, you're considered an accessory and you're equally guilty as if you would have pulled the trigger. Well, the churches have gone out of their way for the last 30 years to destroy evidence, to dig up grave sites where these children are buried, to destroy documents, to get rid of whistleblowers like me in as brutal a manner as possible, and to lie all over the place about what went on in these death camps they call residential schools. So they are complicit as we speak in a crime against humanity. And that's why under the law, they really don't have the right to operate, and anyone giving money to those churches is aiding a criminal body, a body that killed tens of thousands of children and continues to collude in the cover-up of that crime.
From my vantage point, my humble opinion, when I hear of these cases, I look at the poor souls that perish in the hands of these people, these monsters, and I think that for thousands of years, these people have had their own culture, perhaps their own way to express spirituality, and then all of a sudden, an exterior force comes along that wants to absorb them or merge into them or vice versa. And the only way to do this is by just getting rid of them. Is that, what was the real purpose of these so-called schools?
Well, they were two purposes, really, to depopulate the area. They would be set up in strategic areas. Like, as I show in murderbydecree.com, most of the residential schools were situated in the West on very valuable resources. That's because when they were set up in the late 19th century, the British Crown was very concerned that the Americans were going to grab the West Coast of the whole continent. And so they had to get settlers out to the coast quickly. And to do that, they had to get rid of all the Indians. So these residential schools were set up strategically in the areas of the least assimilated Indian populations. So they'd go in, they'd grab all the kids, half of them would die, that would destroy the community, and then the rest of the people would be moved off onto reserves. And it happened systematically. So the first aim was genocidal, simply get rid of them, Indians. But the second aim was to brainwash a certain minority of those survivors, who would then be put in strategic positions on the Indian tribal councils. who today, if you look at your average government-funded Indian chiefs, they were all in the protected group in the residential schools, the kids who weren't beaten so much, who were fed, who were trained to be snitches on the other children, who learned to collaborate with the white authorities, and who were then rewarded later. Well, these same chiefs today are signing away the land to big companies. They're working with the government. They're screwing their own people. Often the biggest drug traffickers on a reserve are the chiefs and their families. I mean, this kind of corruption is all over the native world, including in America. And it's what you do with a conquered people. You get them to govern and destroy themselves through their collaborating, you know, sellouts. That happened all over the world. It happened among my people in Scotland and Ireland. It's happening as we speak.
Not to digress, but I'm just thinking of Mexico. I'm thinking of the United States. Here in the United States, for example, I know a few tribes that they have a preponderance of obesity, incredible obesity, where most of the people suffer from diabetes. And the reason for that is because alcohol is illegal. They cannot process it. But what the government has done, they have placed liquor stores outside of the line of demarcation where the tribes are, and they just become addicted. One of the things that they do there. In Mexico, for example, I know millions of natives are unaccounted. And when I say unaccounted, they're not part of the yearly census that they have. They are not considered a human being in a way. And I recently met one of them at a beach in Mexico, and we started talking. She was teaching me some of her dialect, and we started talking, and she was telling me, where I come from, things are so bad because the government doesn't give us schools in our areas. So at the age of 7, we are trained to leave the reservation, the tribe, and we have to go elsewhere. And that's why you see a lot of kids in Mexico, for example, beggars or selling chewing gum or what have you. And that's the way it is there. Millions of people who do not have a vote, who are basically invisible.
Well, yes, and all of that is coming from the same aim of wiping them out over the long run. And you know, in the Genocide Convention, it says one of the things that genocide is creating conditions where people are going to die off over the long term. That's exactly what's going on. Like, why would $6 billion be spent every year on Indian Affairs Department in Canada, and yet half the native people don't have running water? And 90% of them are unemployed and living in abject poverty, similar to people in Brazil and Thailand. I mean, that's because the $6 billion is going into the hands of white administrators and chiefs who do the job of the government. And the same thing is true in Mexico or America or anywhere. And, you know, you mentioned Southwest America. I should share with the listeners and you the fact that in those reserves, like the Anasazi, the Gila, the Navajo people, the Gila Reserve is especially bad. In Arizona, it's got the highest rate of disappearing children anywhere in America. That child trafficking is massive on the Southwest Indian reservations. And I'm working with a group down there that's documenting this. It shows that local police and social workers are colluding in this. They know that it's easy to grab Indian children and traffic them through the government child welfare system. So, you know, this is happening as we speak, and it's hitting the most vulnerable, the native people who traditionally been the target of this genocide.
You probably heard of the Franklin scandal here in the United States decades ago. Well, that was the very first interview I did with, I forgot his name, Nick, I forgot the reporter's name. Wonderful book, well, wonderful in terms of the data that he included to wake us up. But I remember the reaction, pardon?
Nick Bryant,
exactly. The reaction our listeners had. It was one of those interviews that was so powerful, but people treated it like roadkill. You just go by it, you look at it, and you don't want to talk about it. It's one of those things that people just don't want to listen. Why do you think that is?
Well, fear. They know, frankly, that it could happen to their own. They don't want to look at it because it's so close. You know, it's easy when you're talking about human rights abuses halfway around the world. It's easy to get concerned because you know, it's not really going to affect you. It's safely distant. But we're talking about this happening in all of our neighborhoods, that children routinely go missing. The figure is over 80,000 children alone in America that go missing every year. Well, where are they going? We know the human trafficking industry is global. It's very lucrative. It's got billions of dollars behind it. And it targets the most vulnerable. So I think it's partly fear. And it's also, you know, disbelief is part of our psychological defense. For realizing that we're all to some degree complicit in this. I mean, we pay the taxes, we stand by and let it happen. So under the law of God and man, we are involved in this crime. And that's why we need to change and take responsibility for it.
And it seems that they target the weak, the natives. They target, you know, children coming from broken homes where the mother or the father who's rearing that child doesn't have the financial wherewithal to sue or to pursue action in court to be able to recover their child. So they it goes unimpeded.
That's right. That's exactly what happened.
Now, who? Let's talk about who was involved, Kevin.
You mean in which? The
In this latest one, murder by decree, these missing children or dead children, who really is involved here? To how high does the conspiracy go?
Well, right to the top. The Indian schools, and I want to keep calling them that because, frankly, very little education ever went on in these places. They got rudimentary education, and most of the kids were put to work as slave labor. And so that schools were just a front by which they got government funding and covered themselves. So let's say these internment camps. They were authorized by the Crown of England and by the Vatican. It was a joint agreement, really, to set up the churches and the government. Ran them. Now, the Catholic Church ran most of them. They were actually set up according to a Jesuit model that was used in America and then all over the world to how you go in and destroy a culture and make them make the chiefs Catholic and then wipe out the non-Catholic chiefs and anyone who opposed you. They used that model to set up these internment camps for the children. And so it came from an order in council in Canada. That means the Privy Council. Not Parliament debating the law, but a few cabinet ministers getting together with the crown officials in London, England, and bringing in this law in 1920 that said these children had to go to these internment camps or their parents would go to jail. So it involves the highest level of power in Canada, the courts, the police, every level of church and state and law were involved in this genocide. So nobody is innocent in this whole thing.
Now, the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church, they're together here, right?
Yeah, the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church were the main instigators. Other churches like the United Church, which was actually set up, that's the one I used to be in, it was set up by the government of Canada in 1925, actually. It was a state church, really. All three of them, they were the main perpetrators. And under the law, it means their officers should all be in jail.
Now, what is the TRC? What is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, that was an enormous whitewash set up by the very people who did the crime, the government and churches. After a lot of the pressure that we created across the country when we began to occupy churches and make a big stink, the government came up with this thing they called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was not any kind of investigative body. If you look at its mandate, in section 2 of its mandate, it said it was not going to, it would not conduct any investigation. It did not have the power to subpoena or force anyone to testify about anything. It didn't have the right to lay charges. You couldn't even name names of perpetrators. It was just this kind of vacuous appearance of an investigation that had no power to do anything. The government set it up. The churches funded and appointed the TRC commissioners. So this is kind of like the serial killer getting to appoint his own judge and jury. You know, it was a government church run, quote, investigation. It went on 8 years at a cost of over $70 million. And it finally produced a report that didn't point its fingers at anybody, that lied openly. It said the death rate was 2 or 3% when it was over 50%. And it didn't mention anything about these crimes against humanity. It basically said, well, it's too bad these children were taken away from their parents, and it was sad. But that is why we put together Murder by Decree, which people can actually buy on Amazon and murderbydecree.com. We wrote this book as a deliberate counterreport to show all of the evidence that they had censored out. And that's all in our book.
And that's what we're focusing on tonight. Is this TRC the same? Or is there a relationship here between the TRC in South Africa that was established in 1996 to investigate political crimes committed under the apartheid system?
Only by name. There's no other connection because, for example, the TRC in South Africa said that nothing that the commission did would absolve anyone from prosecution, that they weren't granting immunity, except in the cases of special testimonies that might shed more light on things. But In other words, if you were a policeman who had tortured somebody to death, you weren't given a blanket amnesty by the TRC, but you were in Canada. It said that, in fact, before the TRC was formed, the government of churches announced that they had indemnified themselves legally, which meant anything they said could never result in anyone being prosecuted. So, I mean, it was a complete farce from any kind of justice point of view.
Let's begin by understanding the crime, this killing machine. Let's understand it. Can you define what was used to kill these people and how were they able to hide it so well for so many years?
Well, we've compiled in murderbydecree.com, you'll see in one of the appendices, a very long description of all the crimes. And there are dozens of these crimes, all of them constituting crimes against humanity. If you look in the Genocide Convention, they have five definitions of what genocide is. For example, killing people, preventing births, like through sterilizations or vasectomies or things like that, or abortions, creating conditions to kill them off, moving people from one area to another, and wiping out their culture. Well, all five of those things went on in Indian schools. We proved that from documents, testimonies, everything. The main way they, especially in the early era, but this carried on right to the very end, they would take children who were healthy and lock them in the same dormitories as children dying of tuberculosis and smallpox and then never treat them. Well, it takes months to die from tuberculosis. Your immune system has to collapse. You have to go in under conditions of, you know, poor health, poor food, you know, no warmth at night, to gradually weaken the system till the TB carries you away. Well, the fact that so many people died from tuberculosis meant they were being deliberately kept in those conditions. It didn't just happen. It had to be manufactured and controlled that way. So that's another proof of intent to wipe people out. But there are a lot of other means, outright killing all the time. We've documented dozens of testimonies, and I've sat with the people who witnessed it. I've seen children whipped to death, beaten, kicked downstairs, tortured in special electric chairs.
You have seen this yourself?
And then buried in secret out behind the schools. I've spoken to the people who buried the bodies. We know where 28 different mass graves are across Canada. We even excavated one and found the remains of bones and buttons off school uniforms that turned out, in fact, to come from human beings. We had the Smithsonian Institute analyze those remains and turned out to be from young children. All of that we put out, and it's like there was absolutely no response in the...
Did you say the Smithsonian?
That's right, in Washington, Dr. Donald Orkner.
What did they find, by the way?
Well, Don Orkner was a forensic specialist there, and I spoke to him in January 2012 after we had shipped to him the bones from the Mohawk Indian School in Brantford, Ontario. These bones turned out to be from a five-year-old girl. He said there was evidence of extreme trauma in the bone, but he'd have to come and examine more of the remains to be sure. That was in January. In early April, he died of a sudden heart attack.
Ah.
And, you know, whether or not that was coincidental, I mean, I've had a lot of those so-called coincidences happen with key eyewitnesses and that. But the point is that he confirmed that they were human remains. We broadcast that to the Canadian media. The only newspaper that, or media that ever picked that up in Canada and reported it was one Aboriginal newspaper in Ontario. Now, you'd think the discovery of human remains at Indian schools would be newsworthy, but apparently not to the Canadian press.
And when I talk about the Smithsonian, when I talk about all these entities that seem to be working for humanity, there's always good people there. The unfortunate part is that when they start looking into things like this, they die under mysterious circumstances or natural causes where plausible deniability can be attributed.
Right. A lot of the time, you don't even need to kill people. I've worked with so many people who are so easily scared off. And the rumor and smear campaign on me personally is enormous. It's been in place since 1998. It's all over the internet. You probably run into it. But it's always at the level of kind of innuendo and, oh, he did this without any evidence. And, I mean, that's to be expected when you go up against the church and state, that that kind of attack will happen.
That's why I still have you on here. Yes, I did see a few of those. But I've interviewed so many people in the past whose reputation has been tarnished by things like that, especially alternative doctors. They are appearing in Quackwatch and so on, yet they're curing cancer. And right. They've been told, oh, no, this is, they're full of it. They're not curing cancer at all. People don't listen to it. There's nothing to see. Close the book. Go away. So that is one of those things that attracts me more to listen to your story. And whether it's true or not, what they're saying about you, I'm not going to get into that now. But obviously, you were part of it. You got out. You did the right thing by recognizing that something was wrong. And it's only expected that the hammer's going to be falling on you. So I'm not surprised at all, Kevin.
Well, I remember I once gave a lecture at MIT in Boston, and I was talking to Noam Chomsky. And Chomsky was telling me that during the 1960s, the FBI planted evidence to make it look like he was doing drugs and having sex with his graduate students. And he was challenged about that on a TV interview. And the only thing he said was, okay, show me the evidence. And that's what I always say. I mean, let's look at evidence. If I've done horrible things, let's look at it. But not only has it never been produced, but the very churches and government I've been challenging about their crimes have never sued me once in court. Now, if you're innocent of something, the first thing you do is sue somebody for libel. That's never happened to me. Now, that's the statement right there. If they had counter evidence or they were innocent, they would have sued me long ago. They would have challenged what I'm saying with their version, but they never have. They've just attacked me personally. So it kind of reminds me, Mel, of when I was in law school briefly, I remember our legal process professor said, when you're in court, if the evidence is on your side, you argue the evidence. But if the evidence is against your client, you attack their witnesses. And that's all you do. You delegitimate their witness. Well, that's what they're doing. They try to delegitimately make me because they know they're guilty.
Have you ever been interviewed by the mainstream media?
A few times, very few times. Early on, as this began to come out and I was the only one talking about it, they eventually had to come around because there was such a big groundswell building. There were so many witnesses coming forward. Like I said, we began to cause disruptions in Catholic masses on Sunday morning. We began to really stir the hornet's nest. And that forced some of the newspapers for a while to interview me. After the official version of this crime came down, the official spin went in 2008, then I was completely blocked out. I've never been quoted since in any of the so-called mainstream press.
So basically, it was at one point because of the pressure cooker effect, they had to release some steam and then hoping that it would go away.
Pretty much. And they have pretty much managed the situation. I mean, for example, in June 2015, there was an article for the first time in the New York Times about the Indian schools in Canada. And it said the title was Canada Admits Cultural Genocide. Now, in the article, you see, they always put that adjective in to make kind of soften the blow, cultural genocide. The point is that they admitted genocide, and they also admitted that thousands of children never came back. Well, if a regime admits that they killed thousands of children, you'd think the first question would be, well, where's the criminal investigation? But the New York Times and Canadian government just pass it off like, oh, well, what a nice admission. What's the next story, right?
Well, to me, cultural genocide is, basically, you don't think about death. You think of a deliberate destruction of the culture
right.
Heritage. Basically, people are merging into us, into the new culture, and the old culture disappears. So it doesn't have any killing. There's no connotation of deaths, if you will.
It's part of the Holocaust denial narrative where you use certain words to soften the blow, like the word abuse. Abuse can be anything from calling somebody a harsh name to torturing them, right? So, but it's a very vacuous term. They always use the term abuse in relation to these crimes. No, they don't say murder. They don't say rape. They don't say torture. They don't say mass graves. They say rape, or they say abuse. And that kind of softens the blow, just like the term cultural genocide does. Yeah, cultural extermination happened, but you can't exterminate a culture without exterminating human beings. That's the point.
So let's go back to this loophole part. This is the part that it is so obvious to me that the powers that want to be are in cahoots with all of this government and religious, organized religion, if you will. The issue of intentionality and the exceptional case of group crime. Explain more.
Well, I referred a little bit to that. Under the law, normally you have to prove intent as well as act. So, if you're trying to convict somebody of crime, you need a witness to say, yeah, I saw him pull the trigger. We can't just go from the fact that there's a dead body. Well, under certain circumstances, the rules of intent don't apply. For example, as we mentioned, you got a whole regime of people who are clearly trying to wipe out a group by their actions. You don't need to prove that every single policeman had a personal intent to kill an Indian. They didn't have to. All they had to do was look the other way and obey orders. Now, that group crime means there is an implied intent. Implied intent in the way they operate. And under the law, that's perfectly valid to do that. So the point is that the governments of the world knew that when the Genocide Convention came in. So by all means, they had to shift the focus away from crime. For example, they redefined genocide as simple physical extermination. Whereas originally Lemkin said, when you isolate children, when you take away their language, that's the same thing as pulling the trigger against their head because it's going to kill them over the long run. And so he didn't make a distinction. When the first crimes in the residential schools were brought out, they were referred to as abuse because that put them under a civil act like a tort law rather than a criminal offense. So in other words, they reduced genocide to the same legal category as if you broke somebody's window and then you sit down and compensate each other. It's a tort action. Whereas in reality, it was a criminal action. But by not having it under criminal law, you couldn't prosecute anybody. So they arranged it from the beginning to have the result they wanted.
And here's a quote from, I presume, as a child, in the words of Doug Wilson, quote, "The only reason I survived at that place was I learned to use a knife when I was a very young boy, and I stole food whenever I could. It turned me into something I wasn't, but that's what makes a survivor," unquote. Did you see a lot of these stories repeated again and again?
I've heard hundreds of those stories face to face. For 30 years, I've worked in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is thronging with thousands of Indians who are survivors of these crimes. Every time you meet with somebody, they tell you a story like that. Most of the time, the church and government authorities just let the children starve to death. And so, for example, I talked to Billy Coombs, one of my friends who died quickly. He was one of the witnesses who was knocked off, unfortunately. But he said that the only way he survived, he was the only one in his dorm who survived because he ate the garbage. He was on the garbage detail, and he would stuff the garbage thrown away from by the nuns and the priests. He would stuff that in his mouth on the way to the garbage cans. And he survived. Everybody else starved to death. I mean, and that was in the 1960s in central British Columbia at the Kamloops School.
That's not that long ago. What about other contributory causes of death? I mean, one of them is, as you said, the tuberculosis. That doesn't kill people that quickly. The only way you could die is if you are deprived from treatment, wouldn't it?
That's right. It shows intent right there. You have to deny children proper food, proper heating, proper clothes, keep them in continual state of trauma and fear in order to so drive down their immune system that they can't resist the TB anymore and they die from it. You know, that shows intent, because if they didn't want the kids to die that way, they wouldn't have kept them in those conditions.
And the next part of this is to prevent births, you know, conception, by sterilizing the population. And again, we're focusing on this area in Canada, but I bet you, Kevin, and you know this has been happening for thousands of years, and it keeps happening around the world. We see it in places in Central America, for example, or say Bill Gates, the Bill Gates Foundation comes along and they bring thousands of vaccines, when in reality, it's only for girls between the ages of 14 or 15 and 45. And all of a sudden, these girls cannot reproduce. This is happening all over the place.
Well, sterilization is the key clue that genocide is going on. And, you know, to start in Canada, that I know best, sterilization programs were in these Indian schools from the very beginning. There was a law passed in British Columbia and Alberta, which is where most of the untamed Indians were, and most of the residential schools were. The laws brought in 1928 and 1933 allowed the legal sterilization of any Indian child in one of these schools, or in any industrial school, as they called it. Now, they used X-ray machines, just the way the Nazis did in Auschwitz. They would put the children's... I've spoken to a man called Jackson Steen on the West Coast, who said he was an Inuit or an Eskimo boy who, with his six brothers, was put in the Church of England school in Carcross in the Yukon. They put an X-ray machine over his pelvis for 20 minutes and bombarded him with X-rays. None of he and his brothers could ever have children. That was in 1971.
So they're burned from the inside.
Right. Tubal ligation is common. There are sterilization hospitals. We've mapped 8 of these hospitals across Canada where government doctors were being paid over $300 per Indian woman that they sterilized, especially if they married a traditional chief and didn't go to church. So, you know, they were sterilizing the non-Christian Indians, clearly, and that was being done by all the church denominations.
But historically, there must have been, if the intent was to depopulate the area so that the newcomers, if you will, took over and could protect that area from an invasion from the United States. Doesn't this, I'm trying to just understand the sterilization part here. Wouldn't it be better to just vaccinate the people as opposed to just what they did with x-rays and you know, forced abortions and segregation?
Well, this was to some degree before the era of vaccines, don't forget. And it's simply easier to castrate, or which they did as well, by the way, and chemically castrate later, you know, the boys. But no, there was a whole sadistic element to this, too, don't forget. People enjoyed doing what they did. The white administrators and priests and nuns and everything, they liked doing this to Indians. They considered them animals. And, you know, why would they, for example, like, tie chicken wire around boys' penises and yank it all the time? You know, why would they smash heads against surfaces, make children eat their own vomit in front of the others, make them strangle their pets to death in front of the other children? All of this is psychological warfare. You traumatize the people in that way, and they're always going to do what you tell them to do, including sign away their land. So, I mean, you know, this all has a procedure behind it. A common thing I heard in the healing circles that I began to go to after I got fired by the church, people would say, oh, yeah, they never gave us painkiller when the dentist showed up. They would just yank our teeth out of our mouth or drill them with a painkiller. Well, imagine if that happens to you when you're 5 years old. Are you ever going to go to a dentist? I mean, are you ever going to take care of your mouth or your health after that? You'll be in a constant state of terror.
Well, the trauma, yeah. Like, I mean, all the way it happens here, perhaps not to the extent of that happened to the natives, but we can talk about circumcision here. The first trauma that most baby boys go through in this part of the world and Israel. So that, to me, that trauma at such an early age must have a permanent scar in the person's psyche.
It does, and not just the psyche. If you look at energy specialists, we understand what they call the base chakra in the lower pelvis and in that area of our body. Mm-hmm. That's where we get our sense of groundedness and spiritual centeredness from. If you violate that and you take a young boy's penis, which is a source of not just pleasure, but their sense of manhood and energy and being, and you cause it to be horribly mutilated and tortured at a very young age, you violate that, you upset that energy flow, you make them people who are not grounded and they're afraid of themselves and their own power. And that's what you need if you're going to create a slave population. So whether native or white, it's the same, you know, aim, really.
And what you said, that some of these children, the first thing that they went through was being raped at the beginning. So obviously there's a mind control component here. You do that at the beginning and basically you reign over them.
Yes, and not only that, when they get older, they're
going to do the same.
That's the thing to do to their kids and to their neighbors, and that's how you destroy a culture.
I just cannot put two and two together, meaning religion that's supposed to be good and love, and seeing this. How can people just not get it? The people who continue going to these churches and knowing that these cases are happening to this day, and I guarantee you they are happening. In America, we've heard of all the situations with predators and pedophiles that keeps happening, and even though this Pope pretends to be more apologetic towards those actions, I really don't think that things are changing that much.
Well, they're not, Mel, and I'll tell you one of the main structural reasons they're not is because this Pope, like all the other popes, stands by a policy called crimen solicitanus. Now, you can find that. We've reprinted it. It's in one of the appendices in murderbydecree.com. And it was actually leaked from the Vatican Library to the London Observer newspaper 12 years ago now. And this crimen solicitanus policy says that whenever children are raped by a priest anywhere in the Catholic world, in any country, the police are never to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and anyone who talks about it is excommunicated. Well, that's a criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rape and child trafficking. And any priest and any Catholic in the world is part of that criminal conspiracy. The Pope stands by that policy. He said that when he first got, you know, inaugurated as a Pope. He said that to Italian bishops. You're not obligated to tell the police. We'll solve this in-house. Well, you know how they solve it. They move the perpetrator to another diocese.
That's it.
And they do it over and over. So the Catholic Church, regardless of what your belief system is a criminal body that traffics children, that aids and protects child rapists, that launders money for the mafia. This is all being proven. So again, under the law, they don't have the right to operate, and people are not obligated to give them money.
And it's too bad. I grew up I always say, and not to offend anybody, I'm a recovering Catholic, but I grew up a Roman Catholic, and I had a good experience. The priests were great. They taught me how to play soccer, and they were all great. Perhaps because my father was so involved in the church, nothing happened to us. But, you know, there are some good people in every institution, and we cannot just demonize everybody. But I wonder if those good people know about this. They must.
Yeah, they do know, but they live in a dissociated mental state. And I experienced this with a lot of the clergy. When I showed this to them, they said, well, that has nothing to do with me. And I said, it has everything to do with you. It's kind of like pretending that you're in a family and the father is raping children and I'm really not part of that. Well, mm-hmm. No, you are. All of them are. And, you know, that whole question of responsibility, it's kind of like I was asked to come to Oxford University once. They quickly removed the offer to come and debate when the pressure was applied to them. But the topic was, is the Catholic Church a force for good in the world? And I wrote back to them and I said, you might as well ask the question, is the mafia a force for good in the world? Or Pablo Escobar, the Colombian drug dealer, was he a force for good in the world? Because he sponsored schools. He sponsored programs for the poor. He did all sorts of nice, humane things. And you could say, well, maybe his employees were good-hearted people, but they were still working for a murderer. And that's the thing to realize. You can be a Christian or even a Catholic without being part of a murderous institution. And so I say to like Catholic priests, if you agree with me, leave the church, form your own congregation, cut off all funds to Rome. You don't have to support a multinational criminal body.
All roads lead to Rome. When we come back, we have so much more to discuss with Kevin Annett. And I want to discuss the death quota. There's actually a quota that needed to be met. And I want to discuss that. I know, folks, this is painful information to digest, but wouldn't you rather know the truth about your history, which you will never hear in the mainstream media? And if you ever do, it's probably going to be controlled opposition, or it's going to be something mixed with fiction. So you at least are getting the truth from us here at Veritas. Kevin, how can people buy your books and learn more about your work?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning my website. Actually, that's been taken down now. KevinAnna.com has now been obliterated. So I would go to the other websites, the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, ITCCS.org. That's ITCCS.org. And at MurderByDecree.com, as I mentioned. But you can get my two recent books, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, and Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion. You can get them both at Amazon.com and CreateSpace.com.
I'd like to discuss that title when we come back. Unrelenting. That's and Sodom and Zion. When we come back, this is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important Veritas interview. If you enjoyed it and wish to listen to the rest, go to VeritasRadio.com, click on Members, or Subscribe. Or tell someone else who will enjoy this and all our radio programs. If you are listening on YouTube, like, subscribe, and share it. Don't forget to visit the Veritas store, where you can purchase pure organic sulfur and much more. Now, we'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and I'll see you in the Veritas member section. Enjoy.